Hello, everyone. This is Sunny, and welcome to another episode of Nomads.
Hey there, Sunny.
Hi, Connie. How's it going?
It's going well. I'm really excited for today's episode. We're on episode 9. That's really amazing.
Oh, yeah. And we have our guest joining all the way from London today. We have our first international guest officially joining from London today. It's none other than Alexander Muir. Okay. I'm so sorry about the pronunciation. I'm still getting a hang of it, I guess. I can never be perfect. But Alexander is a UX researcher, and he has done a lot of stuff in his life. He has been in the intersection of technology, arts, literature, and design. And he also is very much into Vedantic psychology and philosophy, which I have no idea about, although I'm coming from India. I'm being totally honest, I'm a newbie in this. So welcome, Alexander, and thank you so much for joining us.
Welcome.
Hello, Sunny. Hello, Connie. It's my pleasure to be here.
It's incredible to have you here. Just to give people a little background, I also met Alexander at the BAD conference, and he gave a incredible talk, and I hope you can go to more in depth because I had never seen the kind of framework and philosophy that he brought. And so I'm really excited to share with everyone today, with Sunny, with everyone. And I'm so happy that you're here and that we were able to talk, Alexander. So let's just jump right into it.
Let's do it.
I would love to know, how did your journey to becoming a researcher start? Like, where did it all begin, I guess?
Well, I thought I had chopped out of university. I'd done a couple of 2 or 3 years at Edinburgh University as a computer science undergraduate. But I was actually getting very depressed and extremely cerebral and lost in my head and just, you know, really struggling to have my day-to-day life feel happy and flowing. So I stopped university. I stopped my classes and I took what turned out to be about 3 years out. And I ended up doing things which are completely different from computer science. I studied physical theater with a Venezuelan teacher who became just an enormous friend and a mentor to me. I went to Venezuela as well, and there I studied, of all things, macrobiotic cooking and breathwork, a type of complementary therapy based in a breathing technique, based in pranayama, as it would be called in the Indian tradition. And I found it really, really helped with my anxiety, helped me very much come back to myself, feel again confident in my skin, and resolved a lot of the sort of overly cerebral trips that I was laying on myself that I was kind of ended up using to stay a bit confused and lonely. I found it cut through that and it was really amazing. I then lived in Miami a little while, again, studying yoga, but I felt my brain atrophying a bit because I wasn't going to be a professional yoga teacher. I wasn't going to be a swimsuit model. I wasn't good on rollerblades. So I thought, okay, go back and finish your computer science degree. When I got back to Edinburgh University in the fall of sort of summer of 99, they said, oh, Alexander, sorry, we miscalculated your credits. You actually have enough to graduate at the moment. I said, okay, fine. So I cashed in my chips and looked for the next thing to do. And I took up at Edinburgh Napier University an MSc course in multimedia technology. And it was in that course, in the course particularly around usability, with the amazing Dr. Katrina McCauley, I fell in love with kind of the whole world of HCI, human-centered design, because she introduced it, that part of the course, as if you're interested in technology, if you're a bit of a geek, if you're interested in psychology, if you're a bit of a geek with psychology, then this class is for you. And it captured my heart at that moment. I went on to do my dissertation with her, and that really started my journey as a practitioner and also working at an academic level.
Wow, that sounds amazing. And that's why I came into HCI as well. You know, I started with engineering. Most of the people start with engineering or medicine in India. We just have two paths to choose from. And that sounds amazing. You know, you have done so much in your life. Now, coming to the current work you do, you are a CX and UX principal researcher at Skyscanner. You have worked with companies like Microsoft, and John Lewis and so on. So what do you think is the state of human-computer interaction currently, you know, since after COVID, everything went virtual? And so
sure. Sure. I mean, it's a very interesting time. I should say, just for the record, I was with Skyscanner, but of course, with COVID, various things happened, and you know, my contract was ended. Unfortunately, I was on the verge of going perm with them. They have a wonderful UX team run by Dr. Oli Maval, a lovely corporate culture. I was really excited to join, but you know, we were all really disappointed that just the sheer practicalities meant that I couldn't. I think nowadays there's a lot of really interesting issues for the field as a whole, and I think there's teething troubles we're getting into, and a lot of the bigger issues really need to be solved by much more international collaboration and a diversity of perspectives from, as it were, the digital north, sort of Western Europe and the US, mm-hmm. to where a lot of the technology is actually being developed, as well as where a lot of the end users of the technology are, which is broadly the digital south. My time in India, which I went to after Microsoft, really showed me there's an incredible culture of innovation there. They're technologically amazing, but they're also dealing with some of the social issues around where technology can and can't improve people's lives, with people at and below the poverty line, which there is about 500 million in India. Then they're really working hands-on with the most difficult issues. So I think for the big issues for UX practitioners are going to be found really by branching out and being quite international in their approach.
Yeah, I'm sorry. You know, as you mentioned about the technological innovations, but you know, the social and bureaucratic infrastructure being limited. I was just reading through your article, and I found the Geek Heresy book very interesting. So any of the listeners who want to check out, we are going to link the article and the book in the description as well.
It's an amazing book.
Because you mentioned that we need to take a more international approach. And I really do think that like a lot of the research we do is so Eurocentric. Lately, it's been very interesting to me how other countries conduct UX research, right? Especially within their own local communities. And so I would love to hear maybe some insight on what does it mean to take an international, like what does it really mean to take an international approach to research? And how can we do that? We have a lot of young practitioners, for example, who listen to our podcast, Sunny and I ourselves. We also have a lot of people who have much more expertise and many years under their belt in their craft. So is there kind of like a go-to approach to do this? Is there things that we can do slightly differently?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of pressure that the young practitioners are feeling, you know, perhaps particularly in North America, because, you know, social issues are perceived as being extremely intense right now. And although I don't particularly want to go into sort of details of what the social issues are per se, but there's this phrase, you know, don't just do something, sit there. If we sort of rush around and add a sort of a speediness to how we're trying to do even very well-intentioned projects, we can actually end up creating just more chaos. And I think that is a difficult thing, because when we feel the need to turn our skills, our professional skills to good, if we feel the need to use UX research and design to solve problems, I think one of the first traps to avoid is feeling obliged to throw oneself into it in a sort of desperate, speedy sort of way. Because frankly, the types of collaborations we need to create to do meaningful international work are not the sorts of things that can necessarily be figured out in a day. You know, we can't do this on steroids, naturally. I mean, for some people may have the fortune that they have at hand a way to collaborate over a slightly long term with a more natural, well-paced rhythm with groups that are based in the developing world or the digital south or however we want to describe it. But many of us don't. And when I was in India, one of the things I saw was I had a slightly unusual position there. I had essentially got there both by intention, but also by happy accident. I did meet a lot of professionals who were coming there for short visits. And it's quite hard work just to come in, do something meaningful in the span of a week or a couple of weeks, and then zoom out. Somehow it doesn't really quite work like that. You know, my firm belief is that to connect this work to our souls, it has to be something which helps us grow as much as moves a project forward. And that can't be done to a deadline. There's something about the way our our heart unfolds itself, which doesn't respond well to being rushed. So when we're talking about a heartfelt international collaboration, a meeting of minds, you know, good research itself can take a couple of months to find its feet, to get deep into the problem space, to work together, to ideate solutions, to do all the rest of the processes. But even around that, we often have to take our time, you know, to relax, to breathe, to be attentive to what's going on in the situation. And so this is a long haul issue. You know, this is a marathon, not a sprint. And so getting ourselves set up so we're in a good physical, emotional, mental, and skills level training position to undertake that marathon, I think is more important than finding a quick fix to the problem. Now, I'm not suggesting you are by any means looking for a quick fix, but our culture here in the West very much promotes that kind of, what's the hack that I can do to do amazing international research today? Yeah, I think we have to avoid that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah, since you mentioned India and, you know, quick fixes, and I'm just curious, what is Vedantic philosophy? So Vedas are called the ancient or sacred wisdom books, the true translation. And Ant means, there is no true translation to English for Ant, but it could be called as beyond. So knowledge beyond Vedas is what Vedantic means. So, and how does it apply to HCI? You know, how did you come across it?
Sure. Well, if we think of different worldviews, which you could say the psychological component of, you know, that which works with the mind and emotions, and then the philosophical component, that which works with sort of high levels of beliefs and that type, that part of the worldview, you know, different cultures often offer different maps. Now, we get so used to the map which we use that often we don't see it. It's like the wallpaper to us. We don't notice it. But without at all trying to judge which is better, which is good, which is worse, a lot of the strength, I think, of these psychologies which we use in HCI come out of an engineering culture. You know, it's a sort of rational, objective. You know, it's very good at making measurements, running experiments. And this is, of course, essential for good science, good engineering. Great. But a lot of what we need to do in HCI is understand people. The mechanism we use to understand people, yes, we can base it on data, on analysis, on some sort of broadly objective observations, but a lot of it comes from our interviews, our conversations, our relationships with people, doing things alongside people, using our intuition, using our empathy. And I found personally that I wasn't being provided as a young person with many good maps for understanding these more subtle aspects of the human experience. You know, of course, empathy and being a good person, it is perfectly well known in the West, but it is not so much a living tradition of how we cultivate a mood that is at once attentive yet relaxed, open yet precise. And how do we tie this into our lives so the work itself helps us grow to be more and more good-hearted? If I was to try and make a case for that approach with my current understanding of Western kind of socio-political psychology philosophy, which is definitely limited, I mean, I grew up in the West, but I do not understand all of Western philosophy by any means. if I was trying to make it, it would end up being extremely complicated. But what I found, for example, when I had that experience years ago doing the breath work in Venezuela, that there's other cultures who have just really cracked ways to look at this and engage with it. So it comes out as being much more simple and workable. So what I found with Vedantic philosophy is it works a lot with some of the key aspects we need as HCI researchers, which is includes our attitudes, understanding how our mind projects our reality, to what extent what we see is our own projection versus what is objectively out there. It has a lot to say in very, very beautiful, effective terms about what stance we should take in the world, particularly with regard to how we should try and serve the world. You know, when we're thinking about the ethics of technology and society, what counts for a meaningful life, what counts for a good life, the sort of the engineering tradition of Western philosophy and psychology sort of shrugs its shoulders and say, well, it's up to you what you think of as a good life. But this rather leaves us hanging. Concretely, Vedantic philosophy, it's based in a set of teachings and scriptures, the most notable of which, of course, is the Bhagavad Gita, as well as the Upanishads and the Brahma Sutra. But it has a living lineage of practice. There are many, as it were, living practitioners who you can see just how they relate to the world itself explains it all. And this is what I found, you can find amazing people like this around the world. No one culture has got ownership of good-heartedness and clarity and kindness. But I found that the way the people I got to work with when I went to India at Amici Labs in Amriti University, they had such a way of dealing with very, very terribly frightening social problems, because they're working hands-on with people in rural India below the poverty line, working with women's empowerment projects in times, quite soul-crushing, depressing situations. But they did so in a way where they were just relaxed, bright, energized, attentive, and doing bang-up work, just great work in really difficult circumstances. And they were doing it round the clock. They were doing it for years without getting burned out. So, I've burned out more than once in my career, and so I was very interested to see what are they doing that is stopping them getting burned out. And in fact, not just not burned out, but the more difficult work it was, just the more radiant and lovely they seemed to be. And I'll just wrap this up with one lovely poetic analogy from Indian literature, which is there's an old myth that the peacock, unlike the other birds in the forest, it eats poison berries, and the poison itself is what gives it the beautiful color of its plumage. And this is used as an analogy for people who've managed to develop the hands-on way of working and the attitude with the more difficult the situation, just the more kind of beautiful and colorful and radiant it makes them. And I wanted some of that.
I think so much of what you say resonates with, I think, anyone who's also worked in social work. I think a big, again, mentioning a bit about like the socio-political and economic things that are or topics in the United States that are becoming very popular nowadays. I have seen this very exciting, and I don't know if it's new, but at least it's new to me, advent of social work and design together, actually. So social workers engaging in design frameworks and designers engaging in the type of mentality and philosophy and approach that social workers have to solve these really big problems. And your point and analogy about peacock and the poison berries and its beautiful plumage, I think we talked a little bit offline before about other types of philosophies that take into account like healing, right? How do we deal with overcoming a lot of these things? And some of my favorite philosophies are like Japanese philosophy of mononoware and wabi-sabi and kintsugi art, which are also some frameworks of ways to see things, obstacles, challenges, breakage, points in your life where you've struggled a lot, and that being a part of your history and adding to your beauty, adding to your like richness of experience, essentially. And I think that's incredibly wonderful. And I think your point about how in the West we're like, oh yeah, we like, in UX, we always say like, oh, be empathetic, like do empathy. But no one gives us a framework of how to heal ourselves a bit to continue to do that work, which takes a lot. We talk about like trying to scale it. We talk about trying to help others, trying to help more people and to help people before that deadline. And even if there isn't a deadline, it can be really hard for individuals to keep going with that burnout. So I think it is true. Like we're trying to think of these otherworldly, like everyone experiences these things kinds of problems with just a Western mindset, which is why I think like, it's very powerful that, and I'm so happy that we're here to share this with everyone today.
Yeah, I think, again, it's a case where we put massive pressure on ourselves. As as researchers, we know that we're trying to identify mitigate bias in our perception. And then, of course, added to that, the national level dialogues related to various form of bias. But one of the things we don't have is, I think, a really effective way to see our own minds in action. Because when we are very still and we're able to see our thoughts unfolding in real time, it becomes, with a little bit of effort and time and practice, we get glimpses of exactly how our minds are sort of fabricating stories about things. And this direct personal experience is very powerful. I think simply being told you have biases, go fix them, makes people pretty uptight often. Mm-hmm. And I find it has not been helpful for me at all. In fact, it normally kind of gets my back up. But then I had this amazing experience. Again, nothing special, but for me, it was a slap in the face moment in a lovely way. I had, after a number of years at Microsoft, trying to get enough vacation time together, I went on a long retreat, which involved being silent for several weeks and doing some sort of particular meditative practices. And I noticed, and about halfway through, my mind kept getting caught and I was feeling this sort of weird nagging discontent. But because of the setting I was in of cultivating enough space of emotional and mental stillness, I was able to see what was going on. Suddenly I realized, I am a really jealous person. And this is extraordinary because, out of all the sort of my faults, which people who know me would point to, probably not, jealousy isn't one of them. It took me to see it myself. And I wasn't able to see it myself without really quite extensive time letting my mind settle down and be quiet, letting the ripples settle, as it were, the waters go still so I could see what was under the surface of my chitter-chatter mind. And that was an experience which, money can't buy. And I don't think I can personally undo my bias without that type of thing. So for this reason alone, I think it's so essential we give ourselves a little bit of breathing space with this.
Since we were talking about, a worldview and creating methodologies or theories that could work from around the world, mixing up the Western and Eastern, philosophies and psychologies to solve problems. How can we implement that for a community-centered design? So if you look at a country like India, there are more than 1,000 languages and there are very diverse communities. I don't see a unifying point even now, when you want to solve a problem or when you want to come up with a new technology. Everyone speaks a different language. It's hard to come up with a technology or an application in 1,000 languages, for example. So, even for user interviews or any kind of method that we try to come up with to empathize with users and find their problems. I have to come up with new methods for different kind of communities. So, diverse cultures need diverse methods. So how do we develop a worldview where we can, amalgamate all these methods or, all these cultures into the picture when we are coming up with solutions?
Sure. I mean, it's a really good question. I think I would pivot it a little bit and say that certainly the approach which I've learned through Amrita University, who does, as I say, this hands-on humanitarian technology research and design across India, focusing on rural India, they take as their axioms that it'll be participatory. It's collaborative with the communities they work with. So there's no sense of, as we're going in there and selling them the solution which we figured out for them. It's much more about working with them collaboratively to identify the needs and the goals, and that they are involved as much as possible in the design decisions. So it grows from the grassroots up. And I think as it grows that way, we will see more national or international patterns emerging. But it's not that we have to, at this point, figure out what's going to work for all of India, not even all of South India, not even all of Kerala, not even all of, this region. Let's grow it from the grassroots up.
That sounds amazing because, I'm even trying to understand different cultures. The more I look into people, I see more obvious similar points, on a holistic level, at least. You want to live in communities, you want to talk to people, you want to build your own memories. That is what gives you a comfort zone. So if I think as a UX researcher, all the methods could have, maybe I'm thinking if I could develop or connect the dots, maybe if I could come up with enough data to understand or, create a method that could be universal is what I'm curious about. Can we do that?
Well, I think so, but it's and I don't mean to sound cliched, but it's sort of the method of no method. But I can be more specific than that. I'm just going to make a quick parallel discussion about the different approaches in the martial arts. So, for example, Asian martial arts are famous for having katas and forms, and you learn sort of set forms. I recently was blown away as I came closer to a community that studies a Russian martial art called Sistema, which very much takes the opposite approach. There are no set techniques at all. The training is much more about how to have sort of the awareness and the presence and the flexibility and the relaxation to respond to situations without the headspace that we need a set form. Now, that doesn't make things any easier in terms of training. You still need to train hard and dedicate yourself if you're going to become good at it. But it never says, okay, if this happens, then you do that. If this happens, then you do that. Because that kind of fixes, it snaps the mind to something. And it really, when I found that, I found it so exciting because it reminded me of something which years ago blew me away from Japanese culture. Again, applied philosophy. It was the writings of Takuan Soho, the monk who was the mentor to the famous sword saint Miyamoto Musashi, who has these amazing letters he wrote to some of his students talking about if you're facing your opponent, and this is a life and death thing, you both have swords drawn. So this is not, this is not chatting time. This is swords are drawn. If your mind is stuck on the sword, your mind is stuck there. If you're thinking about your posture, your mind's stuck there. And he was trying to get this point across, I believe, as you have to be able to maintain a relaxed flow so that all the training you've done just naturally emerges. It's not a case of sort of assessing which technique I'm going to use at this point. So what does this mean for HCI practice? And this is something I have seen as I've been working it myself and training people around the world in it. Yeah, there are some core techniques, but honestly, they're not that difficult. You should be able to have a conversation with people and elicit answers about a topic. You should be able to watch people and watch the situation around them. Of course, there are specialist skills in HCI, like how you use an eye tracker.
Technologies.
How do you do this? How do you do that? How do you do a factor analysis for a big survey? There's definitely fixed forms for some stuff. But broadly, the hardest and most important thing to get across is how to have a user-centered headspace so that when you're there in the moment, in the practice, you can just quite naturally ask the next good question or do the next task, or you just know which next step to take without having to kind of stress about the ideal. So that's how I try to structure trainings when I work with practitioners and students. It's less about recipes. Of course, recipes do have a place, but it's not relying on them. It's more about get lots of experience of asking, of doing lots of UX research with different people about different things in different situations. And you yourself, if you stay relaxed and attentive with the right headspace, the next technique, the next method is going to come by itself, more or less.
Wow. I just loved it. create a method that, for each problem.
Yeah.
So it's being more, I think, there is a saying in Bhagavad Gita. I just started reading it. And coming from India, I have to say, we are more attracted or more fascinated by the Western philosophy or that is what we have followed. So I had an opportunity of going to Amrita University for my undergrad. But people said it is too spiritual, so I didn't even apply. So just wanted to be cool and trying to fit in back then, I guess.
Sure.
Wait, funny segue, actually. I was going to ask with Sunny your story about that, because I think that the West has some aversion or some exoticism around spirituality, for sure. I think especially non-Western spirituality that's not religion, that is seen here, right? I think it comes across as kind of hippy dippy sometimes to some people, kind of souls, chakras, what are those? And then, when Silicon Valley popularized basically just Buddhist meditation camps, just ship off their employees to learn how to calm down and take a break. People were criticizing them. And so I'm kind of curious, what would you tell someone who is kind of a non-believer? What would you tell them about how this kind of stuff works, how spirituality works in the professional world and UX in the West in their own lives? How would we go about having this conversation with people? Because I think clearly we've talked a lot about some of the great things that can come about it. And also, quite frankly, trying to break free of a very like Western mindset as well. So how could I go about in convincing or even incorporating it in our work to try to get people to understand that this, to try to get people to shake off this Western mindset only and to accept a little bit of spirituality?
Sure. You know, I think it's a very good question, and it's a very delicate issue because, you know, particularly nowadays, nobody likes to be talked down to. Nobody likes to be talked to in a way that suggests I have the answers, you don't have the answers.
Right.
You know, it's very easy for people to feel defensive. And so generally, I don't talk to people about this, frankly. You know, the presentation you saw me do at the BAG conference is one of the very, very few public times I've spoken about this outside of a specific community that follows, you know, the
particular practices.
Well, you know, I don't know about that. But I think it is really important because if there's many doorways into it. And again, one of the lovely metaphors from Asian literature is there's 84,000 Dharma doors. There are so many doorways into it. And, you know, what a doorway somebody takes is not necessarily the door we have to open up. There's other phrases which really sum it up, like start where you are. And one of the things which I find is really helpful advice is find people who you think are inspiring, who are able to handle the sort of personal situations you find you can't handle, and learn from them the same way you would inquire how they do it if they were an amazing salsa dancer you wanted to follow or a clarinet player you wanted to follow. Like, how do they work with their mind, their thoughts, their body, their breath, their attitude? Find mentors you find inspiring. And just because somebody else finds person X or Y inspiring does not mean you are legally obliged to, or that you're less of a person if you don't. But if you find somebody inspiring, don't be lazy. You know, do your due diligence and learn from them. Because frankly, your mental health is important, you know, let alone some sort of goal of enlightenment. We are suffering from massive anxiety, depression, rage, ambition. You know, most of us are losing sleep, are far from feeling at the sort of mental peace which is genuinely possible. And so find some connection to something which you find meaningful and pursue it. It's worth knowing that there is a honeymoon period. And then the honeymoon wears off. And then we start to realize that actually the work is undoing our own selfishness. Much of it is undoing our own BS. So it quite quickly becomes, you know, the cold reality of the work will quickly come in. Some people get discouraged at that point, thinking, wow, I meditated for a while and my mind was worse than ever before. It was full of all these awful thoughts. I realized I hate my parents or something. Understand that's normal. And just continue, step by step, bit by bit, the things are as they are. Don't be hard on yourself. Just keep going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even I'm trying meditation. It's really hard. And the problem is being very rigid and opinionated, I guess. You know, I was very naive enough to say, if you don't use an Apple computer, okay, I'm not going to talk to you. But so, you know, we were very opinionated. That's a very basic tech example I give you. Most of the people are very opinionated, and if your opinions do not align with me, then, you know, then we have a problem is the attitude I see. Yes. Most of the times. Yes, yeah, yes. I get over it, but, you know, coming to equity, and I was reading some scriptures where, you know, in spirituality, where it says all life is equal, you know, human, trees and everything. So you have worked in India as well. So the idea of gender inequity has been there, and there has been, as this is voting season, I'm going to point out that there has been, you know, suffrage movements around the world as well, you know, in West. So how do we make sure that the inequities or disparities based on gender or based on, you know, any kind of thing that if they come into technology, how do we address them?
Again, it's a difficult question if we phrase it up like our responsibility is to fix it worldwide. There's some trick of the light which comes around how we tend to have discussions about it kind of in the developed world. We see it from the outside in. We have sort of reports from around the world. These are the statistics around sort of inequality. And if we consider it at that level, we do have a natural inclination, right? Well, sign me up to fix injustice. In a sense, there's a slight trick in there. So, of course, we want to be motivated to make the world a better place. But at the same time, if we start thinking of ourselves as the world is depending on me, that is not true. The world is not depending on us. But we can get an inflated sense of the urgency of what I have to do to fix the world. And that, I think, in itself becomes a bit of an obstacle. Now, it doesn't mean we don't respond to the world, but it does mean that we can start much more locally through some human connection, through community, and again, work through the ground up. So it's not necessary, just as it wasn't a problem we needed necessarily to solve to find a single design language for India, nor is it a problem, I think, that we necessarily have to find a single solution for women's inequality in India. There's quite a big risk, I think, that we can start another wave of cultural imperialism by sort of, from our somewhat privileged positions in the West, saying, okay, oh, you rest of the world, don't you get it? These things are wrong. You know, see the light, abandon gender roles, just get with it. You know, you're taking too long. I mean, everything has a shadow side. And again, one of the challenges, I think, is HCI practitioners as we mature, let alone as people, is to recognize kind of the blind spots and the shadow side in our own worldview. A very simple way around this particular issue is, again, to take the role of a servant rather than a savior. This concept of being the servant, or even the servant of the servant of the servant. So das, das, anu das, as the phrase goes. What I realized is that the only thing I could do was to go to India and in that situation, just support the people who are working on the front line with the women's empowerment projects. They themselves are empowering the women to come together as groups and find solutions for themselves. So perhaps that was a punchline which I should have front-loaded into the beginning of this little spiel of mine. It's not about finding solutions for them. It is empowering the women to come together, find solutions for themselves. Their view of what they want to do may well be different to what we expect they want to do, or that we think they should do. But that's just tough luck on us. If we're going to serve, then it's not up to us to tell our masters, you know, the rural women of India, what they should be doing. I'm there to support them to be successful how they want to be successful.
Yeah, wow. I totally agree. And I think, you know, disparities are there around the world, so that we need to address. So even in India, I see it more. Being a feminist, I grew up being, I come from a society which is patriarchal currently. But my mom was motivated enough to make me a feminist, I guess. But as we are moving towards the end of this episode, I just want to ask you, you have been in multiple countries. You have studied different kinds of education. You have studied technology, music, literature, and now you're working in the field of human-computer interaction. You are the true nomad, to be honest. So what does that mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of people, I've grown up between cultures. And in my case, I have lived in, you know, significant times in London, outside London, in the countryside, in Edinburgh, Scotland, Vancouver, BC, in Canada, Seattle for many years, a year and a bit in Venezuela, et cetera, so on.
Wow.
So I am a bit of a nomad, but strangely, I'm also mostly a homebody. I quite like just being at home and doing unexciting things. This idea,
shame in that.
You know, this idea, there's a phrase being a walker between the worlds. It has advantages, but also challenges by being willing to adapt to new cultures, to work within different cultures rather than find an enclave. Like, I've never been part of an expat community, particularly, you know, I've never related to things like that. I've really enjoyed being parts of different communities and having that sort of relationship. And as what you were hinting at, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. You know, there is a massive diversity amongst people, in the smallest things to the largest things, often in really unexpected, delightful, infuriating, difficult, wonderful, beautiful, bizarre ways. And for me, that has been just an incredible joy over the last couple of decades to be able to travel and live that way. But underneath it, you do start seeing these commonalities come out more and more clearly all the time.
Yep.
That sense of good-heartedness, that kindness, with others, awareness with oneself, just beauty and nobility in the most extraordinary places you find it. It's one reason I feel quite out of step with many people who are sort of superficially my compatriots. I don't fit into a lot of, I don't really fit a lot of the sort of the boxes. But so it can be a bit lonely, frankly. But, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, why do we need to fit into the box is the question I ask. Even I don't fit into any boxes.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, quite. We don't really. That's a lovely thing.
Our band of misfits and I take on the world.
Exactly. I love the name of your podcast, Nomads. I thought it's perfect.
It grew on me, definitely, when we first talked about it, I think. I was like, what does that mean? You know, like, are you talking about, like, physically? Are you talking about, like walking around? Like, but I think truly in the field of HCI and the UX, it's because it's so focused on people, and people are so diverse and have their own experiences, their own struggles, their own lives and challenges and celebrations. I think it really does suit, as like your story just told to us, like so many different things, traveling to different countries, finding all these different experiences, arriving at some point. And along the way, like you've shared so many great insights and so much wisdom throughout. But I would like to ask if there's one piece of wisdom, advice, or lesson, like a key takeaway that we want to leave our listeners with today, what would it be?
Can I just do two, one high level and one HCI practical?
Yes.
I'd say that the book we mentioned, this one by Kentaro Toyama, Geek Heresy, it's so interesting because it really brings out the sense of technology is an amplifier.
Yes.
What is broken and inefficient gets more broken and inefficient. What's strong and efficient gets stronger. So when we're working with vulnerable populations, we cannot just add technology and hope things are going to become more equal. It does not work that way. We have to build on the human resources underneath it, understand where the strengths are, where the weaknesses are, and be very careful to amplify the strengths.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not a techno-optimist in that sense, but I'm very much a human-centrist feeling. If we start from the humans and work outwards, we can use technology well. But then from a higher level, I think mental health is so important, particularly at this time. And one of the most concise, beautiful hints as to how to get towards mental health comes from this amazing humanitarian, Martin Mutinandamai Amma, sometimes called the Hugging Saint or the Hugging Mother, who also founded Amity University and inspired a lot of the work that goes on there. And she said it this way, that physical health relies on the body being active, being able to move, you know, staying mobile, staying flexible. Mental health, which also means mental emotional health, requires the mind and the heart being able to be still. So we need to give the same sort of attention and importance to regularly having some stillness. Not flattened squashness, but spaciousness, stillness, to let our emotions unfurl, to let our thoughts sort of find their natural place, to be a bit like the sky, where all the clouds have got plenty of room to move around. And this is fundamental for mental health. So whatever anybody can do to just get a little bit more of that stillness, enjoy a little bit more mental health, I think that is.
Wow, that was really amazing. And I totally agree that technology is a tool. I tell it to a lot of people, even being in the field of human-computer interaction. I say you have to use it optimally. That's what we focused in a lot of the episodes as well. It is reaching to a point of addiction around the world. We have to get addicted to people. We have to be, you know, in connection with people. We have to make real connections with people and life around us, not with products, is the whole goal of we trying to tell. Thank you so much for joining us today, Alexander.
Thank you.
Oh, my absolute pleasure, Sunny. Connie, thank you so much for letting this eccentric old fool talk a little bit about these things. Whenever else you want to chat about it, anyone else who wants to reach out, by all means.
Yeah, and we are going to link all the things that we talked about in the episode and some amazing, Medium links and YouTube links of Alexander's talks or articles in the description as well. And one more thing is, let me get this dialogue right. Since I'm a Marvel geek, part of the journey is the end and part of the season is the finale. So we are ending this season with this finale as we are coming to the close of, fall semester. So we will be back soon Nomads will be back soon, but let us keep the element of surprise. Thank you so much for joining, everyone. And thank you so much for, you know, agreeing, Connie.
It's been wonderful, everyone. Thank you again to Alexander for being with us on our season finale of Nomads.
Thank you. My pleasure. Good wishes to everyone.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us on this journey as well. Sunny and I also grew as people, and we hope you all learned something as well. Don't be a stranger. Connect with all of us, and we'll see you sometime. Take care. Go vote.
Yeah, and stay safe. All right. This is Sunny.
And this is Connie.
Signing off for this season.
Thank you.
Bye.